Thank you, Jacob, for coming on the podcast today. I appreciate you taking the time. You are the founder and CEO of a company called Superpower. You guys are building a personalized, holistic health super app, something that I've been kind of waiting for and looking for a long time. At least it sounds like the sort of thing I've been waiting for and looking for a long time. So excited to talk with you today. Before that, you founded a couple other companies. You do some investing in early stage startups as well. So maybe we'll touch on some of that as well. But before we dig too deep into anything, would love to, for those who don't know you, kind of get your story from the roles you're willing to start to where you are today, and talk about some of the decisions you made along the way.
Thanks, Jake. Excited to be here. So, anybody that's spent any amount of time in a doctor's clinic or on the phone trying to schedule a painful visit knows that healthcare needs a reinvention. And the reason I'm on this 30-year journey probably starts 15 years back. So we'll wind the clock to when I was 13, teenager. And little Jacob was basically wondering, why is mommy always stuck in bed for half her life? So I grew up in a really interesting environment where dad was in the military, so we were moving around a lot. He was stationed in Taiwan and South Korea, Kuwait, Germany. And my mom was chronically ill. So she had a condition that some people listening might be familiar with, which is a rare form of migraine called cluster headaches. And the way that cluster headaches work is it basically feels like you're literally taking a spear and like stabbing it through your eye. And it's the way they measure pain, it's actually worse pain than childbirth. So she had a really rough time because she was getting these really, tremendously intense cluster headache migraines like 4 to 6 times a week. Like, how is anyone supposed to hold down a job, with that type of pain? And the crazy thing was she wasn't even eligible for disability insurance because she took time off work to raise me and my brother. And turns out once you're out of the workforce for 10 years, you like disqualify from all these different types of benefits. So we were in like a really tough place. And anyway, I grew up on the East Coast, right outside Baltimore, Maryland. So we got her thankfully hooked up with what we thought were some really incredible physicians. I'll use quotes, incredible, because they were it was the neurology team at Johns Hopkins University. And my mom's case was so perplexing and rare and unique that they were actually using her brain scans as teaching materials at Johns Hopkins Medical School. So she basically started getting treatment from them. And what I realized was the reason she was in bed most of the day was actually not because of the debilitating pain of the migraine. It was because the only thing they could do for her was give her a Band-Aid solution that would knock out the pain, but also knock out her ability to live a normal life, which was morphine and Toradol. These are the strongest two pharmaceutical painkillers on the market that you can pretty much get, over the counter in your home outside of a hospital setting where there's a bit more control. And that's how, she was spending her days. And, basically I start getting curious, as a teenager. So I start Googling, what are cluster headaches? How do they work? And end up discovering all of these esoteric internet forums and rabbit holes. I mean, this was like, 15 years back. So we're talking pre-Huberman, pre-Peter Attia era, where people were discussing, different like holistic interventions and things that they were doing that were actually like making a dent in this disease. So, what are your gene mutations? Do you have an MTHFR gene SNP, which means like you don't metabolize or process or absorb B vitamins properly? Are you using certain perfumes in your environment that are like triggering a histamine response in the body and causing blood vessels to dilate, which can trigger the migraines? Are you eating certain things that are very common additives in food, like MSG, which they add to a lot of like different Asian dishes that she liked to eat? So we found out that there was all of these basically like environmental, genetic, and nutrient-related factors that her physician team was completely unaware of. And that's just because it's how the healthcare system works, right? Like, thank God for all of the remarkable advances we see in the healthcare world. But like the reality is primary care physicians don't have enough time to spend a meaningful amount of, head and brain space, like personally working on someone's condition to actually help them get better. And specialists, like she was seeing, they are very like intentionally myopic in terms of what they're able to look at. So they weren't looking holistically at like all of her systems in the body and how everything, you know, was fitting together and what led her to this like diseased and challenged state. Rather, they were only really able to follow the protocol, which is, you know, let's reduce the pain without actually addressing the underlying root cause triggers or getting an understanding of like what might be brewing here, you know, beneath the surface, or what were the series of different, you know, environmental or lifestyle things that happened over like the preceding decades to get her to this state. So from a very early time, I was sort of incidentally building up this knowledge base of how the body works and, you know, realizing that there might be a better way to do healthcare. Outside of figuring things with my mom, I started a few businesses. So I got sucked into this world of Legos, which there's been a few like viral tweet threads posted about this lately. So the secret's kind of out of the bag. But, you know, 10, 15 years ago, there was like a lot of arbitrage opportunities in this market because you could go out to Walmart, buy 30 of a set, part out all the individual bricks, sell it online for like a 5 to 10x ROI. Now there's people that like, you know, do this type of stuff at scale and have full warehouses and they're bringing in millions a year. And the, you know, it's quite an underground secret economy. But that's where I got my start in entrepreneurship outside of, you know, just tackling interesting internet rabbit holes to help my mom and learn about health.
Right. Well, I appreciate you sharing the initial interests in the health side of things. Didn't know of the personal story there. And it certainly makes sense as to why you want to tackle all this and improve the healthcare system, make it more personalized, preventative, everything like that, with what you're doing today with Superpower, which we'll get to. But taking a moment on sort of early steps in entrepreneurship, how old were you when you actually started with like the Lego thing?
No older than 13, 14.
13, 14. So like using like eBay or something like that?
Yeah, we actually had an eBay store. It was my dad's account at first. And yeah, we did quite well for ourselves as teenagers.
Nice. Was it like, you say we, is it like friends of yours or siblings or something like that?
It was my brother and I.
Got it.
So yeah, we had a whole operation with us and some interesting characters we'd bring in from the neighborhood to help us sort and part out all the individual bricks so that we could ultimately sell it online.
Not bad for high school or whenever that was, but pretty good. So did you always know that you wanted to, you know, start companies, like be an entrepreneur, or be a founder, or was that just like sort of an early thing and you had your mind, maybe like, were you thinking about, you know, oh, I'm interested in this health thing, maybe I want to be a doctor. Did any of that cross your mind?
You know, it's interesting, right? Because what we're exposed to from like a media environment, like scripts and biases are thinking. And I genuinely never been exposed to anything like truly entrepreneurial, right? Like I'd never, you know, I'd never been given a book on, you know, great entrepreneurs to study. It just really wasn't like within the data points that I'd been like exposed to. So I didn't know, like, I, you know, it's not like I've, you know, for the past 10, 20 years been thinking I'm going to start a company, I'm going to be a great entrepreneur. I really didn't know, genuinely. What I did know is that I didn't want to do what, you know, kind of everybody else was forcing me to do, right? Like my parents were like, get a job, get, you know, try to go to college, you know, make some money. Like, and I, you know, even when I was in certain social environments, in high school, college, they're just, as hard as I tried to fit in, it just, it never felt like right in like my gut and like my body, you know, like viscerally, right? Like, I think our as I've gotten deeper into health, I've become obsessed with this idea of like interoceptive awareness, which is being hyper aware of the state of your nervous system at all times and like how you feel literally viscerally at like a cellular level in the presence of other people, of certain situations, like, you know, what makes you comfortable, what makes you uncomfortable, and like connecting the dots looking backwards with this like, you know, new realization and understanding. Like I definitely never felt regulated and like everything was, you know, fine when I was growing up and in like traditional, you know, social situations. Even when I moved to New York in my early 20s and I was hanging out with like the investment banking crowd, like I was just like, I didn't know what it was, but something in my body was telling me like, this isn't for me. So it was less of a like a calling and a draw and more of almost like an anti-signal, right? Where like all I knew was that like what I was doing and the people I was spending time with was not compatible with the way that I should be living my life.
Yeah, that's really interesting. How do you like I know you just kind of tried to describe that, but I'm still having trouble like kind of understanding like this visceral body? Like, are you getting like a headache or like pain or something like that? Or is it just like a gut feeling like this is not where I'm supposed to be, what I'm supposed to be doing?
So have you ever received like an alarming text where, you know, someone close to you is like, I have a problem, or like, you know, you see a notification and it's like, oh shit, like that just happened in the world. Like, okay. Like, you know, or you get a text that's like, oh, there's gonna be a tsunami, you know, like about to hit Los Angeles, you know, Venice Beach in 30 minutes, everybody evacuate. Like you would feel something, right? Like there would literally be like a visceral feeling and reaction because you're getting this like cascade of like, you know, norepinephrine and cortisol and all these different like neurotransmitters. It's really like becoming aware, and that's an extreme example, right? Like that is something that, you know, anyone would get a little bit wigged out about unless you're just like, you know, so impressive stoic. But even the most stoic, you're like, they're not immune from just our biological, you know, natural responses, right? Like there's got to be some sort of cascade. So I think it's just, that's an extreme example, but it's becoming aware of like the non-extreme examples. So you meet someone, you talk to them, you know, you go through like a like slightly less stressful situation, and you just start to become really, really aware of how your body state changes and like what might actually be happening on like a more chemical level. So everyone's sort of aware like that this might be happening when extreme things happen, but for less extreme, it's a lot harder. And you kind of have to like train this muscle to become like aware of like, okay, like what's the state of my body? Like what types of chemicals are getting released right now? You know, am I stressed? Am I nervous? Am I anxious? Am I excited? You know, and it's a delicate thing to try and explain because like I'm using, you know, like logical reasoning to explain something that's like a feeling and a chemical cascade, but that's the best, you know, I can maybe explain it.
Yeah, I think of it based on what you just said as almost like there's kind of two things going on. There's like this, for lack of a better word, like emotional volatility or something, like there's something that's kind of volatile, whether you want to call it like emotional or something else. And then there's also like your awareness of that volatility. And so the volatility may be more or less for certain people, and also the awareness level of that volatility may be more or less for various people. And so for you, it sounds like you feel, or you know, kind of came to the realization that your volatility setting is like relatively high, or at least within the environment in which you were operating, it tended to be pretty high. And then over time, your awareness increased to recognize that this is like kind of unusual. This is feels like high volatility. And then in shifting your environment of your life, like doing different things for work, hanging out with different people, has the volatility, you know, gone down at all, do you feel? Or even with the awareness remaining high, like I assume the awareness, once you kind of have it, you can't like reverse it in a way, nor would you maybe want to. So has like changing your life circumstances changed that equation at all?
Yes, it's a really great point. I love this axis, right? Of like volatility and awareness, right? It's like, what is the volatility of your environment? You know, how's that result in your body changing, right? Like what's the resulting volatile cascade of chemicals? And then like, how aware are you of and you're either going to be in like one quadrant or the other, right? And like, for whatever reason, you know, I've just had this like, you know, I now like in a high ranking in the awareness. And because of that, you know, as soon as I found my people and I started connecting with other entrepreneurs, and this was when I was living in New York in my early 20s, I realized that like this is where, you know, I think my nervous system is most at ease. It's where like, you know, the stress chemicals are turning me into an excited state rather than like an anxious, nervous state. So yeah, I think it's all about finding your tribe and your community. I mean, this is maybe why, you know, community is such a like empirically proven lever for longevity and helpfulness. Right. Like there's been a number of metadata, or excuse me, there's been a number of like meta-analyses, which is when you like look at a lot of different conclusions of a lot of different studies in aggregate that show how loneliness and lack of community or the presence of community can be really, really powerful for you know, preventing disease or lengthening life.
Yeah, so pulling on that thread a little bit more, just trying to think of the where exactly I want to go. Basically, I've seen those same kind of studies, and I appreciate that point. And I feel that the world, I mean, this isn't like a novel perspective or anything, but it seems though as though the world is becoming more separate, more individual, less community oriented. You know, you live in an apartment building, you don't know your neighbors, you live in a house, you don't know the people in your neighborhood. but you know the people, you know, they're at the same time, there's a different type of community that's emerging, which is primarily digital. So, you know, there's all these people you kind of see around on Twitter, and then one day you end up DMing them or they DM you or whatever. And next thing you know, maybe you're taking a phone call, and then maybe at some point you're actually like meeting up in person or whatever. And the in-person is like the last thing and like doesn't seem that important. And it's, you know, the rarest, like for every X number of people you kind of are aware of online who you're like seeing content from or whatever, you know, a fraction of those you're actually like engaging with, and a fraction of those you continue to engage with over a long period of time. And maybe a fraction of those you're actually like ending up meeting in person, and it ends up being like a relatively small number of people. But I'm basically skeptical of the idea that this current thing is sustainable. Not that it like can't be sustained, but just that it won't be. I think we shifted very quickly from a world in which, you know, offices provided a certain level of community for a lot of people. And the remote trend was like kind of in its infancy and rising fairly fast for what it was, but it was like, you know, single digit percentages of the workforce. And then it jumped to, I don't know exactly what the numbers are, but like maybe like 40%, 50% or something like that of certain industries, at least, if not kind of like the overall or something like that. And then, you know, it corrected when COVID was kind of lesser of a concern, and it went back down, but not down to like 2 or 3 or 4%, down to like, you know, 25% or 30% or whatever it was. Like it sort of went up a ton and then corrected down a bit, but not all the way. It's like once the world changed, it doesn't just flip right back. It only goes part of the way there. A lot of changes that came from COVID that seemed like they would be temporary turn out to be a lot longer lasting than people think, just because when you flip the default, it doesn't easily flip back, especially with something like working remotely, where there's a lot of freedom that people really like about it. And so, you know, an office only has so much power over their people to bring them back to the office, because if they don't like that rule, they can go get another job where suddenly there's a competitive advantage to allowing your workforce to work remotely. So all that said, there's a situation now where a lot of people are working from home alone. And I don't think that's going to be the long-term future. I just don't. I think there's, you know, it's not going to be necessarily return to offices, but there's got to be something where people are spending more of their days in person with people, I think. And you ran an interesting experiment on this with Launch House, which, you know, you worked on before Superpower, and now you're still investing out of Launch House Fund, I believe. So maybe you could talk a little bit about, you know, what that experiment was about for you, and you know, like what you saw throughout that was kind of interesting, or seemed like maybe it gave you a glimpse into the future, and then maybe other pieces that, you know, as it is an experiment, obviously things, not everything's gonna be perfect out of the gate. So things that you saw or did during that maybe if you were to run something like that again, you might do a little differently.
Yeah, well put. You know, the community has been sort of the common thread throughout all of the businesses I've built and experiments I've run. So my first company before Launch House was called Comsor. And we were basically building Salesforce for community, go-to-market, and partnerships teams. And that company grew really fast. You know, we added $70 million to the balance sheet from a handful of investment rounds in a really short period of time. And, you know, we're working with really big enterprise customers. And we made the interesting decision to build that company fully remote pre-pandemic. So my prior business partner and co-founder CEO, he had started an all remote online gaming business, you know, back when he was like 15. So, you know, I was like scouring, you know, integrative health internet forums and selling Legos on the internet. And he was, you know, running like this big Minecraft gaming network and, you know, had like armies of people all over the globe working for him totally remotely. So we had like a lot of experience with, you know, building a remote company in a remote culture relative to most businesses, you know, that were completely on the other end of the spectrum. Like startup building fundamentally changed with the pandemic, just because of like, you know, the new access to talent and, you know, increased emphasis on remote work. But that was like the culture and the climate with which we built my first company. And, you know, it works to a degree. Like we had ridiculously lower burn relative to most other competitors of ours in the space, or even like average SaaS companies, because we hired talent from around the globe. So it can really, really help from a talent acquisition and like a lowering of cost perspective. I think, so it worked from a company standpoint. I think from a executive founder standpoint, it was actually a little bit more challenging, in the sense that, you know, I think that when you are building something that's like that ambitious and audacious, it's really, really hard, you know, to maintain like your motivation and your sanity when you're just like locked away, you know, in like your Manhattan apartment, with no one to like bounce ideas off of or chat through. And this is where like I started to realize, you know, there were certain gaps in my life because I didn't have access to great community, right? Like I'd have amazing community every time I'd open up my Zoom or every time I'd open up my Slack, you know, or my email inbox. But, you know, when it came to actually like the people that I was spending time with outside of just like the day-to-day grind of trying to build a really crazy company, I didn't have much, right? Like I actually didn't have that many founder friends, surprisingly, and believe it or not. So fast forward to Launch House, you know, one of the inspirations for that business was like, let's find a way to solve all of that and do it by building an institution that really, really leans into the magic and serendipity that can be created by in-person community. So for those listening and aren't familiar, Launch House was effectively a next generation incubator and founder community that we started in, I'd say, late 2020. And the idea was like something like Y Combinator meets WeWork meets the Stanford dorm room, right? So what if you combined those three concepts and what would you get? Well, you'd get like a really amazing place to live, to work, and to incubate your company and take it from zero to one. So over the period of 2 years, we helped close to 1,000 founders get their businesses off the ground by running these like 30-day long residency programs where entrepreneurs, mind you, this was like during, you know, the midst of like the global pandemic. So people were like a lot more flexible with their living situations and arrangements. But we basically asked people to uproot their entire lives for 30 days, you know, contrary to what was happening with like Y Combinator and Techstars, where these programs were going like completely remote. You know, like YC had ran its first all remote batch earlier that year. And we actually had some like members that were going through YC at the time. And they like also wanted to come through Launch House to join our community because they were like, we moved to San Francisco, but like there's no one around in the streets, you know, and like there's no founder events. Like where's the community, right? Like Zoom breakout sessions just aren't quite the same. So that was sort of like the original, you know, inklings of inspiration for Launch House and what we were seeking to do. The idea is as like there's as different like phase shifts happen in industries or in markets, you need new institutions, right? So, you know, as like Silicon Valley was shifting to be like broader than just this definition of, you know, San Francisco Bay Area, and as it was, you know, broadening to be more than just like millennials building businesses, but also like Gen Z, and you know, as like modern media advanced and like TikTok started to come onto the scene, like we basically figured it to be like the perfect formula for, you know, a new kind of institution to come and a new brand to be built that founders could really rally behind and get around. So that was sort of the idea behind Launch House. More tactically, what that looked like is we rented a crazy mansion. So we put Paris Hilton's former estate in Beverly Hills, you know, and turned it into a startup incubator effectively in like a co-working space. So every 30 days we'd have 25 new founders come in. We did this in LA for about 6 months, then we expanded to New York City. And so now we were operating like a bi-coastal platform where we would host events every single week to bring together like the different startup founders and investors and just like people interested in building in these different ecosystems to talks. And we had very structured programming where every single week we would like teach founders like, hey, here's how to think about fundraising. Here's like the best practices for growing your personal brand as like, you know, a distribution strategy for your business. We'd bring in, you know, big name TikTok influencers that had like grown large accounts and say like, you know, what are the secrets? Like, how can we basically use these channels to organically acquire customers and own our own, you know, audiences as a company rather than just being like, you know, a renter of Facebook and Google ad treadmills. So that was the big idea and, you know, some of the kind of early inner inspirations and inner workings of Launch House and how that sort of played into, you know, the shift to remote work.
Right. So a few questions just based on like this, you know, trying to piece together various aspects of like future of living and working. You guys landed at like, you know, these residencies, I understand, were like a month at a time for, you know, however many people could fit in like sort of one mansion. Did you have thoughts around kind of like the size of the group and the duration of the stay that you considered toggling, or not toggling, but moving these like twisting the knobs a little bit on these different amounts to see like what the right formula is? Because to me, like the ultimate thing you would want would be something that's not just like a one time, 1 month break, but something that is more, renewable, like almost, you can do for maybe, but maybe it's a month every year, or maybe it's 8 months every year, and that's your main thing, and then you're going and doing something else. Or like, how could it fit into the larger picture of someone's living? Because, like you said, it was like an anomaly of a time where during COVID, everyone was like all messed up with their living situation or whatever. And it's like, oh yeah, I'm paying for rent here, but I'm going and living at home or whatever. But for a long-term, like sustainable way of living, you need like, the finances need to work out, like logistics need to work out. You can't be paying for rent here, but spending 3 months here, or at least most people can't. So you end up paying double rent basically. So how did you guys think about like those different dials, those different knobs?
Exactly. So that's what ultimately ended up, making that part of the business model unsustainable, and why we moved to just sort of being like a venture fund and an online digital community. So, the model that we honed in on was a 30-day like live-in incubator program, so to speak. So rather than, having an incubator program where it's, intensive with different training and workshops and opportunity to kind of work on your company problems with other like-minded peers and get help, is it wasn't on Zoom, and it wasn't, hey, move to the Bay Area for, 60 days or whatever Y Combinator used to do. And like you come together for events once or twice a week. It was like, no, let's like dial up that to the extreme and actually have everybody living under one roof, which ultimately what we learned produced insanely deep human connections. And it all comes down to just the math, if you think about it. Right? Like, what are friendships? Friendships are, I think at the end of the day, like, not to sound like overly transactional and like reductionist, but it's really like, I think a function of like the level of depth you're able to go with people, right? And then the frequency of touch points. So it's like, how deep can you connect, right? In like a one-on-one session where like you find you have common interests, or you both get like, a certain amount of like dopamine and excitement and the right like chemical releases, from your conversations and stimulation. And then like, how often do you have that, right? Or even if it's like infrequent, or is like the intensity, right, of like the touch point so dialed that like it doesn't matter. Like, you could talk to someone once a year and like you'd still be able to like just like that, pick right back up. But with Launch House, it was such an intense like on bo it was intense on both spectrums, right? Because we were highly curated the folks we brought together. So everyone was very like-minded, had the same identity of like being an entrepreneur, and was like opting in to be there, right? Like literally uprooting their life for 30 days to go, trust some like guys that were putting on a program to help their company. And they were seeing all these founders literally from like the moment they woke up to brush their teeth to like the moment they went to bed, right? It's just like a constant like barrage of connection. Like, you literally were not leaving the house even, because it was during COVID and there was like a lot of lockdowns, so people like weren't going out and partying or going out to restaurants even. Like, we were eating all of our meals in the property. So and you didn't even really want to leave the property because it was so lavish, right? And like an amazing, extravagant and beautiful environment. So that was, I think, the key learning, is like we were able to help people become like insanely deeply bonded relative to any other social experience they've ever had, and cultivate, some of, what I've heard, like the closest friendships of their entire life. And the funny thing is, there was like this meme that was going around the community called post-launch house depression, where because the environment was so intense, right, and like every single day you were just constantly stimulated again from sun up to sundown with like-minded people in like this COVID bubble effectively. When you left, like the first day of like your return back to home, whenever you'd leave the program, it was actually depressing because your brain just like was not used to being away from this like highly stimulated, highly frequency of stimulation environment, right? Like, just picture yourself, you're in a mansion for 30 days with like 30 amazing like-minded people, ideas are bouncing off. Like, literally, when people walked into Launch House, they were like, wow, I feel like there's an energetic force at play here because of just like, you know, the creativity that is brewing, you know, everywhere, and like the conversations you overhear, and like, you know, the excitement that people had to be there. So it really was like a magical place for a lot of those reasons.
I know that all makes sense. And I think, like, I've personally experienced, you know, it's kind of shocking how like meaningful or like deep a relationship you can develop with someone or with a group of people after spending like even just a week together, let alone like a month, if it's depending on the experience and what that is and how close you are and how many people there are and stuff like that. But like, it's kind of shocking. I mean, like, one example is, you know, pledging a fraternity. Like, you spend 6 weeks with a bunch of guys and like you get incredibly close, because, I mean, there's different factors involved there, but one is like you're sort of like struggling together, which is, you know, it's like same thing for guys who go to like war together or play sports together. It's, you know, these are similar dynamics basically, where there might be some element to like getting through something very difficult together, even furthers some of that, maybe just because it sort of increases some of like the realness in the experience or how, you know, close you can get to one another or whatever it might be. And it's just, it's surprising. And then oftentimes, you know, you move on from whatever that experience was for a week or whatever it was. And, you know, you don't talk to those people for a long time. But to your point, earlier, you know, maybe you reconnect with them down the line and it's like, boom, you just kind of, you can kick it right off, kind of, because there's already sort of like that foundation there. So it sounds like, you know, super valuable what you guys were able to do there. If you were to do something along those lines again, I know you're hyper focused on health, so it's not a practical reality, but hypothetically, if you were to advise someone who wanted to do something similar like that in the future, what would you do differently? Like, why isn't this, you know, there's like this sort of magical energy when you walk in the house and things like that. Why, you know, why not do that longer than a month? Or maybe it's not 30 people in a mansion, but maybe it's, you know, 10 houses with four people each in like a town somewhere that you still are curating from the digital community and still bringing people into this, you know, physical community. And it's just, maybe it's not quite as intense because maybe that's not long run the ideal or something like that, or some other version of this. I'm just kind of making one up, but how would you think about sort of going back for something like that in the future?
Well, here's one of the big realizations. Community doesn't scale. It doesn't scale. It really, really doesn't scale. I think as soon as you start to scale it, the definition changes. Like, it's less of a community and more of like, you know, a broader identity and affiliation, honestly. Mm. Like, I think communities have to be defined by intimacy. And community can be engineered, right? It's like semi-formulaic. You touched on one of the important pieces of the formula, which is shared struggle, right? What makes communities really, really bonded and strong? It's like this idea of shared struggle. And literally packing up your life and moving to like a foreign environment for 30 days with people you don't know, and you're trusting that it's going to be because you'd like want your, you know, company to succeed. Like, that's, it's a big risk and it's tough, right? To like live with a lot of these personalities and, you know, navigate this environment, and like everyone's really pushing everyone to like work harder because, you know, no one wants to be like the startup that, you know, didn't end up closing their round. So like shared struggle was absolutely, you know, a key part of like why the community was so bonded and why things work, but it's really hard to like engineer that at scale. You know, a second piece of the formula is shared identity, which you can have at scale, but like, you know, I think everyone was an entrepreneur, right? Like, they're a founder. Founder, it's like this propaganda thing, right? Like, people just want to feel like they're a founder. It's and I think that can also have a downside, right? Like, there's certain scenesters where like they want to have the badge and the title and be able to put it in their LinkedIn bio, but like they don't really know what it takes as far as like a work perspective, and like they're probably, you know, not going to make it. So there's like all these different aspects, you know, of like kind of the formula of community. Another one is continual traditions. So like consistent traditions, like people need to know like, hey, this is what we do as a group. Like, we meet every week, we do this. And like, you know, I think you can do some of these things at scale, but it's ultimately really, really, really hard. So if I were to do it again, you know, or saw someone else trying to build community, I actually would like recommend figuring out a way to keep things as intimate as possible for as long as possible. And, you know, figure out what are your economic incentives here, right? From like a financial sustainability perspective. Otherwise it gets really hard. And the other big learning from Launch House, which is, you know, sort of a segue, excuse me, to what I'm building now with Superpower, is, you know, I had a really unique window into daily life of the average entrepreneur, I like to think. And what I mean by that is most of these people, although intellectually highly prolific and you know, we had some really great companies come out of Launch House that, you know, like have gone on to do quite well. And irrespective of all that, so many of these founders did really not know the first thing about taking care of themselves or, you know, being holistically healthy in all the right ways. So, you know, it was really evident, right? Like with people's sleeping habits, working habits, eating habits. And I know it's hard, you know, when they're in a foreign environment, but still, like, I actually made a point to host a session for most cohorts with one of my longevity physician friends, where we would talk about all these aspects of holistic health. And it was probably like one of the most captivating, well-received seminars or, like talks that we do every single cohort, because people are like, wow, I never thought about toxins in my food or, you know, pesticides on my food. I never thought about like not working up until the point that I would fall asleep. Like this was literally before even Andrew Huberman had like broken onto the scene, right? Who's now the top five in global podcaster and everyone seems to know his name and it's become a meme, right? Like, this was a few years back. And, but that's where like I started to see these patterns and realized that, you know, if we want to help build generational companies of the future, the hardware and software of the human being, of like the executives and the founders and the leaders at the helm of these businesses, is just as important to take care of as, you know, investing in all the hardware and software of the actual like business machine itself, right? Everything from like your SaaS tooling to your processes. So that was kind of the early light bulb moment for me, coupled with all the health things that I've experienced, you know, personally with my mom, that made me realize people need new heroes in health. People need help. And there's really not anything out there that is actually solving this problem. So that was the early inspiration for Superpower and how it connects back to Launch House.
Right. Well, I appreciate you making the segue for me. I would love to dive more into to Superpower now. What was like, I mean, you've talked about some of the early motivations, both from what you saw at Launch House with founders and your mom story and everything like that. But when did you actually decide like, okay, I'm actually going to go build this thing? And what's it been like sort of the early stages of bringing this together and making a reality?
I've been building this for about a year. And the, you know, the big idea is, when you go to the doctor, you're frustrated, right? Like you can literally now like learn more from 7 minutes of listening to a health guru podcaster than you can from talking to your primary care physician. Yet they're the gatekeepers to the medical world. And you know, it's really no challenge of their own. Like I love doctors. I feel for them. God bless them. But the reality is, because of the way we've designed the incentive structure for healthcare in America, you know, physicians are not incentivized to, or paid, you know, basically, you know, incentives affect behavior, to keep up and stay abreast of like the cutting edge of the research, the cutting edge of like consumer health and wellness innovations, supplements, and just like understanding of like frontier medical literature. It's not a thing. They're also not incentivized to spend a ton of time with you, because most doctors get paid on volume, right? It's called fee for service is the model. So they only get paid if they see a patient, which means that they need to maximize the volume of patients that they see. And the more time they spend with you means the less patients they can see in a day, which is like less take home for them. And, you know, these people have medical school loans and families and mortgages. It's just, so it's really, really challenging. And it's created a lot of gaps. And basically the big idea behind Superpower is, let's close the gap. Let's rebuild a doctor's clinic of the future from scratch, from your phone, and make it super easy and accessible to understand and access the frontier of healthcare.
Let's get into some of like the nitty gritty of what you guys plan on doing, like how you plan on sequencing some of what you're planning to build. So I understand, like, to start, correct me if I'm wrong on any of this, but you guys are going to sort of start with like the base being, you know, annual blood tests and testing for a bunch of different biomarkers and things like this. And then there's going to be like sort of availability for one-on-one meetings with like your personalized health person. I don't know if that's a doctor or like someone, you know, different or whatever it might be. And you also have sort of access to all of these different, you know, like all of the latest cutting edge products and tests and whatever it might be. So you're trying to be like the hub, but what's the sequence or order in which you're trying to introduce things or like sort of the strategy you're going about accomplishing this like massive goal?
today, healthcare is a super fragmented experience for consumers. If you want to holistically optimize yourself, you have to run around town to a bunch of different doctors. You have to spend time on a bunch of different e-commerce stores. You have to do genuinely probably hundreds or thousands of hours of research on like what's legit. And like, you might not even know, right? Like, is this supplement manufacturer just snake oil? Is it? So like, it's really, really challenging. So we're trying to basically reduce that friction and bring everything together into like one trusted ecosystem so that people can get one place for clinicians, doctors, tests, have all their health data in one place, access any of the products or services, buy trustworthy supplements that are third-party vetted and like pharmaceutical grade. Nothing, by the way, is ever Superpower branded. We're completely third-party agnostic so that, you know, and don't make margin on this stuff. It's more just like a convenience factor. Since trust is paramount, right? Like, people are literally trusting us with their futures, with their families, with their bodies, with their health. Like, it's the most, you know, crucial, important, you know, piece of ourselves, right? Like, we're walking miracles. So we take that really, really, really seriously. But imagine one place to access everything, plus one place to view all of your health info for life. Like, no more, you know, wrangling spreadsheets, PDFs, you know, disconnected test results from different systems, but rather it's all in one like integrated interface. And the starting point is this platform and product experience we built called the Superpower Baseline, where we make it super easy to test everything in your body. We send a nurse right to you. Like, it's just like ordering DoorDash. It's pretty simple. And we get a baseline read. Plus, like, we have an intake, you know, process where we capture everything from like were you born C-section or vaginally all the way to like, you know, do you use polyester bed sheets? Since like all these things can like impact, you know, everything from microbiome to your hormone status. And we marry all that together with some of our clinical algorithms to give you like a flat out understanding, like, where am I at today with my health, right? Like, how do I compare to others in my age group? You know, what's going to kill me ultimately, right? Like, what are the risk factors and things that I should be aware of based on like my unique, you know, family history or genetic profile or, you know, different things that we can see in your test results, and then make it really, really easy and actionable to actually implement that stuff. Cause I think that's where like, you know, too many testing companies that I've seen fall off is they're just like, cool, here's a bunch of results, but like, go have fun. You know, and then people are left with like a similar problem, because the problem is everyone in healthcare and digital health and like consumer health is just building a point solution. It's a point solution. And people don't need more point solutions. People need aggregators, bundlers. They need one-stop shops. They need super apps. They need a trusted partner that can genuinely help them navigate this entire emerging world. Because we're at this like exponentially, you know, increasing point of the curve where more and more healthcare and digital health innovation is happening. It's not going to slow down. And anytime you have like that type of Cambrian explosion in a market, value will inevitably accrue to aggregators and bundlers and companies that, you know, can just like reduce friction, search time, and burden for consumers to navigate a landscape like that.
Right. So along those lines, what are like the most interesting and like cutting edge available products or like point solutions today that you would envision like wanting to sort of bring into the fold? Like, whether it's, I see you're like wearing an Oura ring, I think at least, you know, there's that. Yeah. There's you know, 8 Sleep Bed is like another sleep thing. Right. And then there's, you know, you can get your metabolic health through these, you know, continuous glucose monitoring patches or whatever it might be. There's all sorts of wearables, Apple Watch, et cetera. And then outside of wearables, there's like other categories of things like very specific tests that you can take. All of these sort of point solutions that you mentioned, even down to just tracking your fitness, tracking your workout, tracking your run, whatever it might be. Are you guys planning to sort of bring all of that into your all-in-one solution or offer that independently? Like, you know, recreating some of these things, just how do you think about that?
So basically everything you mentioned, you know, is more or less on the roadmap or already available today. Like, we could send you a glucose monitor, you know, yesterday, or we have Oura Ring on our marketplace as an example and can integrate your data. So yeah, consumers are demanding more.
All right. Well, I wish we had more time, Jacob, but I know we're up on the hour. So appreciate you taking the time. Where can people go to, you know, follow you and what you're doing with Superpower?
Yeah, you can go to superpower.com. Or find me on Twitter at J_CUB, J Cub.